Accession number 5202, Reel 1.
Mr. Salmon, Reel 1. Could I ask you, first of all, Mr. Salmon, when you first joined the Army?
Yes, I joined on the 1st of June, 1934. I joined in London and then spent 12 months in the RA depot, Woolwich, training as a trumpeter.
Did you specifically want to go into the Royal Artillery?
I was, after going into the Royal Air Force, I was interested in aircraft at that particular time, as I think most boys were. But due to the age, the Royal Air Force wasn't taking people until they were at least 17. So I did the next best thing, I joined the Army.
How old were you?
I was 15 at the time.
So you told an untruth about your age, did you?
Oh no, they were taking boys in for training as trumpeters at the age of 15. But the Royal Air Force that I wanted to be a member of, they weren't taking people until they were 17.
Was there any particular reason why you decided to join the Army?
Oh yes, I was just following in the footsteps of my father that was in the 1418 war in the Royal Artillery.
Now, we can't go into your early training and service, but later on you found yourself in Hong Kong in 1935. Can you tell me how you got your posting to Hong Kong?
Well, after doing the 12 months training at Woolwich, we were invited to submit the names of places that we'd like to go for posting. And there was a number of places on a list, and I chose Hong Kong as my second choice and Mauritius as my first choice, and it turned out that I was posted to Hong Kong. Why I chose Hong Kong, I have no idea. It just happened to be at that particular time a long way from England, and I think as a boy you're very adventurous, and that made me put down Hong Kong.
Had you heard any stories about soldiering in Hong Kong from older servicemen?
Not really.
So you went into it with your eyes blindfolded?
Oh yes, completely new. Place and new equipment and new uniforms, etc. And I left England on the new troop ship Neuralia.
What was the troop ship journey like?
Well, it took 31 days, which is quite a long time, through the Suez. It was extremely uncomfortable due to the heat, because there was no air conditioning in those days. They just had a canvas wind chute that was put down into the holds.
Was this an enjoyable voyage for you?
Oh, yes, because we stopped at Gibraltar, Malta, Alexander, Port Said, Bombay, Ceylon, Singapore, and then Hong Kong. We were only able to get off twice. Once was in Alexander, and the other one was in Singapore.
What were conditions like below deck?
Pretty cramped. We were accommodated in the between decks, and we slung hammocks the same as they do in the Navy. And during the day, the hammocks were rolled up and stowed away, and gave quite an area for training, because a certain amount of training went on while the troop ship was going out. Started off with PT in the mornings, and then rifle drill, a certain amount of map reading, different schooling that could be done in between decks or on deck of a troop ship.
When you got to Hong Kong in November 1935, What were your first impressions of the place?
Well, it was a marvellous harbour that we went in, but of course we'd passed through so many ports, and they were all strange and new to us, that Hong Kong was just another port at that particular time. When we got into the port itself, we stopped in mid-channel, and we were put into lighters. And I was with a draft that was going to Lai Moon Barracks, which is at the eastern end of the island, and I think it was about 20 of us in our particular draft. And we got into a lighter, and the lighter took us to a shore just below Lai Moon Barracks, and a place called Pachi Wan. And then they had a very narrow road that led from Pachi Wan, which was an ammunition area, right up to about, I think Lai Moon Barracks itself is about 500 feet above sea level, and there was just a narrow path going up, which we found out afterwards was called Chinstrap Hill. And you can imagine what it was like in the semi-tropics, going up this hill carrying a kit bag and all our other equipment, also dressed up in our khakis, which we had never worn before, topies on our head. And of course when we got to the top we were saturated with perspiration. But that was our first impression of Hong Kong, was walking up a very steep, narrow hill carrying all our kit.
And what were your barracks like?
Barracks, the barracks were quite extensive. Lai Moon was a Royal Artillery regiment, was stationed there, the two complete batteries. And it was very well laid out, very airy on the top of a hill. The barrack blocks had wide verandas around each side of them, and they were very high-ceilinged. And they did have fans in all the barrack blocks, so it was quite cool, actually, inside.
What was the weaponry at this particular site?
Anti-aircraft. We had the old 3-inch 20-100 weight anti-aircraft guns, four guns to a battery. The two batteries were 7 battery and 9 battery, and they made up the 5th anti-aircraft regiment.
And how many men would be stationed there?
I think each battery, the battery strength was just over 100, I think, per battery. So you could say 200 plus regimental headquarters, plus all the auxiliaries. There was a certain amount of transport. Say about 300 altogether in the regiment. That's only a rough guess.
And what were your own duties then?
I'd passed out as a trumpeter until I reached the age of 18. My job was purely as a trumpeter. I was one of 5 in the regiment, and we used to do our guard duties with the guard, and we used to play reveille and all the different calls during the day, and up to retreat and nights out at night. In those days, all the commands were given by trumpet or bugle.
Can you describe a typical day that you would spend at Lai Moon?
Yes. First thing was being woken early in the morning with a cup of tea. The pre-war staff of the barracks, amongst the local population, they used to supply what we used to call boys, which used to come in, and for a small amount of payment each week, they used to bring you tea in, and they used to shave you if necessary, even while you were in bed. Boots were cleaned, and a certain amount of equipment was also done by them, if you wish them to. A lot of the hard and dirty work connected with the cleaning of the barracks was all done by Chinese labour, which was very cheap in those days.
What was the relationship like between the soldiers and these barrack servants?
Well, it was quite a happy relationship, but there was always that class distinction there, that we were the colonials and they were sort of people just employed by us. I'd be true to say that they were looked down upon as being second-rate citizens in those days. But in the morning we would start off by usually about 7 o'clock PT for half an hour, 7 to 7.30, then we would break for breakfast until 8:30, then we would have a battery parade. Battery parade would go on to such things as gun drill or all types of training connected with the anti-aircraft regiment, for instance, height finders and predictors and spotting. And this went on from, say, from 8:30 till 12:30, with a break of half an hour for what we used to call a naffy break. We used to go and have a cup of tea and
naffy break.
A naffy break. Usually a cup of tea and a bun. Then lunch, or we used to call it dinner in those days, and dinner used to be at 12:30. Then from 12:30 to 1:30 was a break for the dinner. Then after dinner there used to be another battery parade, but it used to be only for sports. There was very little training ever done in the afternoons there, especially during the summer months, due mainly to the heat. In those days, without air conditioning, etc., it was extremely uncomfortable to do any heavy work anyway in the heat. So it was compulsory sport, mainly such things as swimming, water polo, cutter races, football, hockey. These were the main sports that was carried on by the troops in those days.
And all this equipment was provided by the army?
Oh yes,
it
was. You must realise in those days there was no such thing as television sets or even radios. I think we only had one in our particular battery radio set. So entertainment was what we made it. We used to form little groups and go and climb up the mountains. Just behind Lai Ming Barracks is a mountain range of about 1,500 feet. And it was quite a job to climb up this. Remember that we had no proper equipment in those days. We just had plimsolls and normal clothing.
So what would you do in the evenings?
Tea used to be at about 4:30, 4:30 to 5 in the evenings. After that, unless you were on guard or picket duties, you were able to go to town. You had to parade in the guard room before you went to town to make certain you were properly dressed. In those days, if you were in uniform, you had to wear slacks and long sleeve shirts. This was mainly because there was a lot of malaria out there pre-war. If you were in civilian clothes, you had to wear lounge suits and a trilby. You were never allowed out without a hat on those days. And you could go to town, and it was just a case of walking down the hill and catching a tram. I think it was about the cheapest journey in the world in those days. It would go from one end of the island to the other for five cents, which in those days, if you reckon on the dollar being about 1 3, you can imagine how much 5 cents is, 1/20 of that. So it's an extremely cheap journey into town. Of course, in those days, we never had much pay coming in. As a trumpeter, I think I had five silver dollars a week.
How much would a dollar be?
That was about 8 shillings. $5 was about 8 shillings, or 7 and 6, 8 shillings. It used to vary because the dollar was floated in those days. But so that it's obvious we couldn't go to town very often, or if we did, we were on an extremely limited budget. But things were cheap there. You could go to a cinema and come out of the cinema, have a good meal and perhaps a bottle of beer, and all this would cost you about a shilling. So most people used to go out at weekends, but it was possible to go out during the week if you had the money or the time and your inclination.
How much contact did you have with the local population?
Very little, apart from the Chinese that were employed actually in the barracks, either as cleaners or workers or delivery people. Of course, it was possible in Hong Kong, especially in the red light district. A lot of the chaps used to have girlfriends down there, and some of them even learnt to speak Cantonese. But they were few and far between. There was very little actual contact. The community in those days was divided more or less into three sections. You had the Chinese section, which was the bulk of the population. You had another section, which was the service people, in which there was quite a lot of service people in small place like Hong Kong. You had about five regiments out there. And the third was, of course, the civilian population, the European population, which was very elite and to some extent snobbish. A lot that used to have their own particular areas and their own clubs, and Twain never met as far as the other ranks were concerned.
What did the soldiers think the attitude of the European civilians was to the army?
I don't think that we ever considered it as being I don't think we ever had any resentment, because you had the same type of society back here in England in those days, and it was just an extension of the English class system being transferred to a place in the Far East.
What did keeping a Chinese girlfriend involve for a soldier? I mean, how was it arranged?
Well, it was usually arranged by the soldier renting a room not too far from the barracks itself, perhaps below Lai Moon in a place called Shek Kwai Wan, which was a fishing village, but you could get a flat down there at a very, very low cost. And the girl used to be installed there, and they probably had a radio set, and the girl was able to do a lot of little bits and pieces for the soldier, like washing and ironing, and a bit of sewing if necessary, and things like that. It sort of home away from home. I mean, barracks in those days was quite wasn't the comfortable barracks that they are today with all amenities. In those days it was very stark, and although it was livable, it was It was a crowd of you all together all the time. There was no way in which you could separate and have a little bit of peace and quiet, perhaps. And this was overcome by a chap having a girlfriend. He had a place to go to and he could relax and perhaps read and write his letters and everything that in peace and quiet.
How did the soldiers find the girlfriends in the first place?
Oh, usually in the dance halls. There was no other way in which you come in contact with the Chinese girls, only through dance halls or perhaps even the brothels. Some through the churches. This was about the only avenue in which there was a breakdown of the class structure was in the churches. If you were, say, or a soldier was, the Salvation Army, well, you'd go to a Salvation Army and there'd be people from all walks of life go there. Or Methodist, or the usually the bigger churches, like Church of England or the Catholic community, they still had to some extent the class distinction, but the smaller churches, they had a breakdown in the class structure.
So you mean they would meet through the social activities around the church?
Yeah, there was one or two places in Hong Kong that catered for troops, or they tried to bridge the gap between the Europeans outside and the service people by one or two clubs. The one that comes to mind was the Cheerio Club, and they used to have whist drives and beetle drives and bridge drives and this was a place where service people could go, but there was women that was volunteers. They used to volunteer their services, same as they do in the WVS now, very similar.
What kind of relationship did the soldiers have with these girls? Was it was it purely a kind of commercial relationship, or was there genuine love?
I think it started off purely as a commercial, purely for sex. It started off, but invariably a lot of these girls, they really, they're very loyal to the chaps concerned, and this went on, as you probably heard, in the prisoner of war years, where a lot of these girls, or you could say they're common law wives, although common law wives weren't recognised in those days, used to smuggle food into some of the prisoner of war camps for these people. That they were completely loyal.
Did marriages actually develop from these relationships?
Some did, but it was extremely hard for marriage to take place for the simple reason that the army itself or the services was against mixed marriages in those days, as I think society in general back here was against mixed marriages. Now, of course, it's free and easy and you get a lot of them. But in those days, it was more or less frowned upon by the powers that be, and they would put obstacles. They would post chaps if they thought that a chap was on the. They couldn't stop people getting married, but they could put as many obstacles in his way as possible. He wouldn't be eligible for married quarters, for instance, and or any of the marriage allowances. And they would transfer him down to Singapore or further afield if necessary.
Did this actually happen, to your knowledge? Did you know of instances where this actually happened?
Oh, yes. Yes, this was quite common. Until war broke out, and then all in 39. Of course, out there we think of the war starting in 41 because it was under peacetime conditions or semi-peacetime conditions right up until the Japanese attacked. Whereas back here, of course, from 39 onwards, you're on a war footing. But from 39 onwards, all the normal trooping season, which used to be for about 3 months of the year, and servicemen could more or less say to the day when he was going to leave, because he'd know which troop ship he was going to be on, even 2 years, 3 years ahead. Because all this stopped once war broke out in Europe.
Was this system of Chinese girlfriends, did it have a special name?
No, not really. No. They were just Chinese girlfriends, that's all.
So the soldiers didn't have any particular name for these girlfriends?
Not really, no. Not that I can recall, anyway.
I thought I'd heard some people refer to them as down-homers or something.
It may have been, but I've never heard it. Or if I'd heard it and never registered.
Would these girls be more westernised than the general run of the Hong Kong population? Or would they become more westernised with contact with the British Army?
I think with contact they would become more westernised. They probably, if they were girls that had been in a dance hall or even brothel or anything like that, of course they had a lot of contact with service people, and they must have picked up a lot of Western manners and ways, and even a certain amount of the language. Very few troops in those days could speak the local language, so therefore it was the conversation had to be on from the girl side learning English rather than the service chap learning Cantonese. Although invariably, once they were living together, the chap soon picked up Cantonese.
Would they wear Western style clothes or Chinese style clothes?
Usually Chinese clothes. Very few Western clothes were ever worn then.
Was there ever any hostility from the Chinese civilian population to this happening?
Oh, no. In a lot of cases, these girls, they used to support their families, perhaps poor families, Chinese, by this relationship. So that in a lot of cases it was... they were encouraged to form these relationships. The girls themselves, I think, were looked down upon by the rest of the bulk of the population. They were in a class by themselves.
What about the Japanese population in Hong Kong before the war started?
There was quite a big Japanese... quite a big Japanese what you might call a contingent there, mainly in Kowloon, which was the other side of the harbour. They owned a number of shops too. They were pretty well throughout the business life in Hong Kong, and it wasn't till the Japanese actually went into China, at least into South China, which I think was 1937, that there was any hostility shown to the Japanese.
By whom?
By the local Chinese population. But once they had attacked, they went through Bias Bay into Canton. Then, of course, a lot of the population in Hong Kong used to have clansmen or relatives, relations living in the areas, very in Chinese territory but close to Hong Kong, and of course this set up a certain amount of hostility to the Japanese, and there was shops got their windows broken, and there was not going to say riots, but they were pretty roughly treated in places. Most of the Japanese sold up and left. It was about 37, 38.
How did the army regard the Japanese civilians?
Well, I never come in contact with any of the Japanese. I couldn't answer that question. Really, there was one or two of our officers that could speak Japanese or a certain amount. But what contact they had with the local Japanese population, I couldn't tell you.
To your knowledge, were they regarded as disloyal before the war broke out? Or potentially disloyal?
Disloyal to the Japanese nation?
No, disloyal, a disloyal element in Hong Kong, a danger to security in Hong Kong.
Oh yes, from about 1937-38 when they attacked up in China, of course. All our, shall I say, our service training was to the effect that Japan was the enemy, not China or anything like that, but it was Japan was the enemy. In fact, I was interested in aircraft identification in those days.